The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Let me say this. This is just a general statement, and that is that management, in general, is the allocation of limited resources. That's what you do in a business. If you're the manager, you allocate resources that are limited. You have so much people, so much money, so much raw material, and you allocate it to maximize your profit. That's what management is all about. Now, in the Church of Jesus Christ, the primary resource is God. I think we should always understand that. That helps keep things in perspective. God and His power are our prime resource. There is a problem, however, with God and His power for us, and that is we don't control Him or it. We can't allocate it. We can't take the power of God and say, we'll use so much of it over here and so much of it over there and so much somewhere else. Now, that would be nice if we could, because it's an unlimited resource, the only unlimited resource, and it is our chief source of power, but we don't have access to it according to our will, only His. Now, we pray for His will and His power and His strength whenever we do anything, but it's up to Him to give that power. So when we talk about our management of resources, we can't really talk about the power of God. The church's most apparent resource is people. And this is a limited resource. Now, if your church has 50 members, you are limited to 50 people. It's a limited resource. If you have 100, you have 100 people. If you have 1,000, you have 1,000 people. But it's limited. Your church may grow, and then the limit grows a little bit, but it's still limited. Now, the Church of Jesus Christ has other resources, as you know, facilities, money, programs, traditions, reputation, relationships in the community, all kinds of resources. But basically, the church is in the people business. So if we're asking the question about how well is a church being run, how well is it being managed, we're really asking the question about how well are people being used in the church. How well are people being served? How well are people being used? Because we're in the people business. So the management question in terms of church is basically a people use question. Now in economics, experts and pseudo-experts always try to find some way to quantify everything. You've got to measure everything. I can remember in one economics course that I had that we were studying about people's usefulness about with regard to different products. How much did they want these products? And so we discovered a thing called a util or something like that. You got to quantify everything. Well, how do you measure people use? What form can you find? What item can you find to measure how well people are being used? And the answer, I think, to me, is simply this: time. Time. I think that's the unit you can best use to measure how well people are being used. In the case of an individual, his use of his time is a fairly effective measure of his use of himself. So that this is true with regard to an individual. Time management is self-management. Time management is self-management. And the same thing is true in a church. That the way a board's time is used, the sessions, a board of deacons, Sunday school officers, the way a church body uses its time is the way it's using its people. The way it uses its people. Now, we want to learn, and I want to learn in my own life, not to see time as something over there, something I manage or deal with or handle that's over there. I've got to get out of that. I've got to learn to see time as me. And I think in terms of people, we have to begin to learn to see time in terms of people. If I bore you in this hour, I apologize for that in advance, but I have taken an hour of your time. And that's an hour of your life. And I think we need to begin to take a more serious view of time. You have 24 hours a day. I have a calculator on my desk at home. You have 168 hours a week. You have 8,736 hours a year. You have 524,160 minutes a year to invest. and it's all you have each year. And it's you you're investing when you invest that time. So in the church, or in our individual lives, time is not some isolated commodity to be treated casually. Time is people. Now, before we look at a few specific items in relation to time, let me say a few general things about time from the very beginning. And one of them is this: time belongs to the Lord. When the Christian talks about, and we say this sort of thing, I don't know what to do with my time, that's not Christian. It betrays perhaps a wrong view of our gospel. Or somebody will say, she didn't know where her time went. That's an expression that we use. Her time went. Our time belongs to the Lord. We need to have that straight. Or we say, I just didn't have enough time. It's the Lord's time. It's not ours. Psalm 31, 14 and 15 records the psalmist's prayer, and this is what he says: But I trust in thee, O Lord. I say, thou art my God. My times are in thy hands. My times are in thy hands. It's God's time, not ours. I think that's very basic. So that we are stewards under God, not only for the way we handle our money and our land and our possessions and whatever. We are stewards under God for the way we handle our time, which is really his time. But no possession is more valuable than time. No possession. We regard it as a very precious commodity, a very valuable limited resource. We regard it as us. Listen to Paul's admonition in Ephesians 5, 15 and 16. This is what he says: Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time. The book of Proverbs reminds us over and over again of the importance of using time well, of not wasting it. Listen to Proverbs 10, 4 and 5. Lazy hands. Tim Keller could have used this with relation to his deacons. Lazy hands make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. He who gathers crops in summer is a wise man, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. Jesus has a harvest going on now. The Proverbs writer said, he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. And that brings me to my first point tonight, first major point, which is this: wasting time. And what a shame it is to do that with God's rich gift, which is virtually the equivalent to life itself, wasting time. God's lordship over time is one reason we should not waste it, but it's not the only reason we shouldn't waste it. One other reason is very obvious. The supply of time is strictly limited. You get only 24 hours each day. That's all you get, no more, no less. It's a strictly limited supply. You shouldn't waste it. Just this week, when I was trying to put some of these things together that I'm saying tonight, I was reminded that time is like manna. You only got enough manna, except for the Sabbath, for one day at a time. That's all, no more, no less. You couldn't save it. It turned rotten. You couldn't take Mondays, and if you didn't eat it all, save a little for Tuesday. You lost it. It was gone. And on Tuesday, you couldn't get Wednesdays. If you were especially hungry on Tuesday, you couldn't get Wednesdays in advance. You just got one day's supply at a time, and that's the way it is with time. Morning and evening, that's all you get. Day and night, 24 hours a day. It's a precious commodity, and we shouldn't waste it. Maybe, in addition, we forget that the supply won't last forever, sooner or later, maybe sooner than later, maybe today, maybe tomorrow. Perhaps a long time from now, your supply will just stop. No more time. Now that's good for Christian. Now, of course, you'll be in heaven where time is not important anymore. You'll be in eternity where I don't think you watch the clocks. And that's good. But your supply of time is all gone. You're going to run out of it. No more allotments, no more manna, no more time. You're all done. A precious commodity. Use it with care. The Bible further reminds us that time flies. It moves fast. And we'd better use it while we've got it. The older I get, the more alert I am to the truth of that, that time flies. Job said, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. The psalmist speaks of our years this way: they are soon gone and we fly away. I don't know how many funerals I have had. I don't keep those records, but hundreds, I guess. where I have reminded myself and the people there that life is like grass. It grows up in the morning and it withers and dies in the afternoon. Life is like a vapor, it's like a cloud, it's like a puff of smoke. It just comes and it goes. And we forget that. We ought to treat time more seriously. It's not something over there. It's you, it's me, it's us. And yet we waste time. We waste time. Now, how do we waste time? Well, I could tell you some ways that we as individuals waste time, or ministers waste time. Telephone can be a time waster. A casual visitor that comes into our office can be considered to be a time waster, I suppose. Crises can be time wasting as we engage in firefighting. Poor filing systems can be time wasters when we forget that the purpose of filing something is to retrieve it, not to lose it. Those are personal kinds of time wasters. Answering mail is a time waster sometimes if you don't do it efficiently. Reading unnecessary material is a time waster if you don't read carefully. But there are other kinds of time wasters that we share as individuals, but also as groups. And we're talking about groups tonight, and sessions, and deacons, and church boards, and church organizations. How do we waste time other than these very personal ways? Well, one way we do it is by indecision. We do that in sessions. We're doing that right now at Westminster Seminary. We have an issue there that's been before us for 5 years, and we have just not been able to reach a decision on it. Indecision. And frankly, it's hurting us very, very badly. Some of you may know about it. I'll talk to you about it afterwards. But we need to come to a conclusion. Indecision is a time waster. And one reason that we fear to make a decision, I think, is because we're afraid of making a mistake. There's some risk involved in any decision at all that you make, some risk. Another time waster is procrastination, picking things up and putting them down again. Pick them up, you look at it, you put it down. Not indecision, you never even come close to a decision, never even think about it. You pick it up and look at it, put it down. I've got a thing on my desk now. It's a simple thing. Every year I have to get together little ads for our January courses and put them in Presbyterian Journal and elsewhere and hope that people will come. And it's an easy thing to do. And every year I procrastinate. I could have done it in May. It only takes a half hour. It sat on my desk until last week and I've finally done it. It took the half hour. And I've procrastinated. And why is it a time waster? Because I have looked at that thing 30 times. Or I have picked that note up. I didn't take much time, you know, a minute. I picked it up and looked at it and thought, I'll do that another time. I just put it down. Procrastination. Time waster. Another time waster is perfectionism. Perfectionism. We have to learn to live with imperfection. Those of us that tend to be perfectionists. It's not likely that you're ever going to do anything perfectly as long as you're dealing with imperfect people like yourself. And perfectionism then can be a great time waster. Not long ago in the Harvard Business Review, and I say not long ago, it was about a year ago, there was an article called Criteria for Choosing Chief Executives by Harry Levinson. And in the back, there's a chart that you might find very interesting. He lists here 20 categories, and then he evaluates potential chief executives from poorest to best. And one of these is relevant here, I think. The topic is tolerance for ambiguity. Can stand confusion until things become clear. And the lowest ranking is this. Needs to keep focus on one defined project at a time. I would have thought that's pretty good. Guy does one thing and finishes it, and he goes over and does the other thing and finishes it, sees it all the way through. That's the worst. The best is can tolerate ambiguity for years. Doesn't get anxious waiting for long-term plans to come to fruition. Interesting. Perfectionism. Another time waster. Inefficiency. Job poorly done has to be corrected or repeated. A job half done, you have to pick it up again and do it all over again. A job that you start without analyzing in the first place, without analyzing the problem, you're already solving it. You get in trouble, and that's a waste of time. Another time waster in our church experiences is communication. Communication that's too long. Where you explain a thing and explain a thing and explain a thing until it's all explained out and you've lost the enthusiasm for it. Or communication that's too short where you didn't even share the essential information. Or communication that's too vague, and you never really did make it clear at all, or communication that's just incomplete. It was complete in part, but it didn't share enough of the facts. Communication can be a great time waster. But I think in church life, in my experience, and I want to balance this against what Marlon Hardman said about the many values that can come from interaction in small groups. I think one of the biggest time wasters in my experience in the Christian church is meetings. Now, maybe you don't feel that. Maybe you think all meetings are run efficiently in the circles you run in, but I think meetings are one of the biggest time wasters that I experience. And I think we need to think in terms of human energy and hours. There were about 20 of us here through the evening tonight. 3 hours, okay? That's 60 hours. 20 people here times 3 is 60 hours. I don't know what the average income today is. I can't keep up with it. I used to make 25 cents an hour. I thought that was pretty fine, but maybe $10 an hour. I don't know. But these are more valuable hours than work. I mean, these are hours you could be home with your family or home watching Dallas. What's on television? I don't know. You could be home doing something else. These are more valuable hours than work, so let's call them $15 an hour. Okay, 20 people, 3 hours, that's 60 times 15 hours, $15 an hour, that's $900. Now, if we start thinking in those kinds of terms, maybe our meetings will be a little shorter. Or a session with 6 people, or 8 people, or 10 people. Start adding up that time that's wasted very often. I heard of a company the other day that did this kind of thing. They had a clock, and whenever there was a meeting, they'd put that clock on the table, only it didn't have time on it, it had dollars on it. It had the dollars on it that meeting was costing. And the company, whoever it was, the executives, would say, okay, yours is a $3,000 meeting. Anything over $3,000, you're going to pay. And the meetings would end on time. Meetings. I just think they're a tremendous waste of time often. And I suspect some of yours are. You know Parkinson's law. Work expands to fill the time available for its completion. If you've got 4 hours for a session meeting, you'll fill it. You'll be sitting there after about 2 hours and think, we're almost done the agenda. And one of the good brethren will find something over which to have a controversy for another hour and a half. It's my own conviction that nothing good happens after 9:30 in session meetings. Now, that's a generality from my experience. I don't know whether it fits yours or not. The other day I was looking at a list of these laws and I found Oeser's Law. I don't know who he is. O-E-S-E-R. Oeser's Law. There is a tendency, said he, whoever he was, there is a tendency for the person in the most powerful position in an organization to spend all his time serving on committees and signing letters. Time. Meetings. They are too large often. Too many people are there. There are people there that have no interest in the subject being discussed. They are too long. They are too frequent. They are too dull. They are too vague. And they are too pointless all too often. So they are a time waster. Well, the waste of time puts us under tremendous time pressure. What do you do when you're under time pressure, personally or in the church? One thing you can do is withdraw. Not from the church, but just, you know, from the pressure. Just back out, give up. I can't do any of it, I'll give up. Another thing you can do is to work longer and harder. Ministers work hard and long, as many of you know. I've seen some surveys, and I've done one or two, indicating that ministers work 60 hours a week, sometimes 70 hours a week. My own feeling is they probably work at an efficiency ratio of 30%, maybe 50%, so they're really working 35 hours a week. They're just spreading it out longer. And one might ask, why do ministers work like that? Are they trying to prove that they're essential or that they're necessary? Or is it just the pressure of time? Or maybe they haven't really studied their own schedules. So one thing you can do is just work harder and longer. Another thing you can do is just avoid the issue, the burden of time, the pressure of time, and blunder on. Or you can wrestle with it and try to manage your time. And the first step in managing your time, and I realize that in the short space of the time that we have tonight, some of the things I'm going to say are simplistic. The first thing you need to do is evaluate your time. Evaluate your time. And that has to do with setting priorities. And this has to do with individuals or with sessions, setting priorities. Do you remember the story of the man who was with Jesus one day and Jesus said, come and follow me? And the man said, Lord, I'll do that, but first I want to go home and bury my father. Now, that was the custom in the time, as I've read in Barclay's commentary at any rate, that a son stayed home until his father died. Now, the guess is, if you look at the Greek and the text there, that maybe the son was only 20 years old and the father may have been 40. And maybe he had to go home for 20 years till his father died of old age. And that was a good thing, to stay with his father. But it wasn't the best thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But it was a question of priority. He chose to do that instead of following Jesus. Priority. A critical question. Priority. The priority question is really the question of the allocation of time. We say, I don't have enough time. You've got enough time. You've got enough time to do almost anything you can think of doing that's reasonable. A session says, we don't have enough time. You've got enough time. But it's a question of how you allocate it. Everybody has 24 hours. Everybody has exactly the same amount of time, 24 hours. You've got enough time. The question really is for an individual or a session or a board of deacons, not whether or not you have enough time. The question is, what do you want to do with the time you have? It's an allocation question. It's a priority question. Now, let me urge you to a general rule, and that is simply this. Do the important things first. For a session, that might revolutionize the session agenda. For an individual, do the important things first. Now, often we do the urgent things first. And you've heard it said and probably read it, the urgent is rarely important and the important is rarely urgent. The other day I found an urgent note on my desk. It had been written 3 weeks ago. There was a student in Korea who had just arrived in New York, seminaries in Philadelphia. Had all kinds of problems. He arrived at the airport, all sorts of problems. There's a note on my desk, I'm to take care of it right away. Well, I lost the note. 3 weeks later, I found the note. Well, that was urgent and it was important, but somehow I blew it. In the meantime, he's never come to seminary. I don't know what happened to him, but he solved his own problem. It was a misfire. It was a mistake. We shouldn't have gotten the call, whatever. It cleared up itself properly. The urgent is rarely important, and the important is rarely urgent. Do the important first. Now, that may mean not doing what you would prefer to do. When I look at the stack of stuff on my desk, I usually pick out the thing I want to do. I should pick out the most important thing and deal with that, get rid of it. There is a word that some of us need to learn, and it is the word no. That's a priority question, a priority statement, no. Refusing, said Alec McKenzie, refusing to do the unimportant is a requisite for success. Refusing to do the unimportant is a requisite for success. McKenzie said that the word no is the greatest time-saving word in English. No. Most ministers have not learned that word. It took me a long time to learn that word. You know what no is? It's the lowest priority ranking. Somebody asks you to do something and you say no. That's the lowest ranking you can give to anything on your priority list. I've adopted a new habit. I'm comfortable with it. You may find it sinful, I don't know. But somebody will call me up, for example, and ask me to be at a meeting or speak at a meeting or attend a meeting or whatever. And I'll look at my schedule and I'll see that that day is open. But it's a day I had planned to stay home with my family. And I have simply learned, if I don't think I need to be at the meeting, I've simply learned to say, no, I'm sorry, I'm busy that evening. And that's fine. They don't ask what I'm going to do. And I don't tell them I'm busy with my family at home because I don't think they'd understand that. At least some people wouldn't. And I've learned to say no. And it sure is a helpful thing. And I think if many ministers, and laymen too, but especially ministers in this case, would learn to say no, they'd get away from those 70-hour weeks and 60-hour weeks. And people wouldn't be offended. They'll understand. Learn to say no. Critical word. Instead, we get so busy and so involved putting out fires in our congregations and in our churches. And you know what you do? Alec McKenzie also said this. You know what you do when you put out fires and make that the highest agenda on your docket? You assure that you will have fires tomorrow. If all you're doing is putting out today's fires, you can be absolutely sure you'll have more fires to put out tomorrow. So first of all, if we're going to manage our time effectively, we need to set priorities. We need to evaluate time. Secondly, we need to organize time. You need to evaluate time, that's setting priorities. Then you need to organize time. That's called planning. It's been said, when you fail to plan, you are planning to fail. You need to organize time. What is planning? Planning is dealing with the future, and future is a time word. Planning is dealing with tomorrow's time. It's deciding in advance what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. It's a forecast of time. That's what planning is. Planning is deciding where we should go and how we're going to get there. It's deciding what we should do and how we're going to do it. That's all. Planning is simply that sort of thing. Why plan? Why plan at all? To help assure that what you want to happen will happen. That's why you plan and organize your future time. God has designed a time for everything. Read Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and you know it well, verses 1 through 9. God has a time for everything, and so should we. We should plan. Now, let me just call your attention to Matthew 6, where Matthew says that we should not worry about the future. Matthew 6, 33 and 34. Do not be overly concerned about the future. But there's no excuse in the Bible anywhere not to plan for the future. Jesus planned all the time. He planned a mission and a ministry. He planned to call the 12. He planned to train them. He planned to send them out. He planned to go to the cross and die. It was all planned. It was his plan. There's no excuse in the Bible not to plan. Now, there are so many things written about planning and so many books. I just want to say one thing about planning tonight, emphasize one aspect. I want to talk about dreaming and fantasizing, because I don't think we do it enough. Somehow, I get the feeling that we conservative Christians don't do it enough. We don't dream and fantasize in our own lives and in our church's lives. Students come in to me from time to time, or I visit with them or have lunch, and we talk about what they're going to do with their lives. And I don't know whether you know this or not, but there's an increasing number of students who now come to seminary not knowing what they want to be. I think it's about 30% at Westminster now. They come seeking God's will for their life, whatever that will might be. So career counseling becomes very important, and informally is the best way to do it. And they'll say to me, I don't know what I want to be. And we'll begin to talk about it, and they'll focus on, I don't know what the Lord's will is for my life. And obviously that's good, and that's a proper way to go about finding that sort of thing. But I'll say, listen, for just a moment, let's forget what God's will is for your life. Let's not talk about that issue. Just tell me what you would like to be. Dream for a minute. Fantasize. And I'll say something like, can you think of anybody whose job you'd like to have? Can you picture yourself teaching in somebody else's place in the seminary or in a college, or preaching in some pulpit? Can you think of somebody's job that you'd like to have? Dream about it and fantasize. Create your own dream. Now, I don't think that's totally unscriptural. There's a verse in Psalm 37, verse 4, that says, delight thyself in the Lord. That's worshiping and loving and serving him. The rest of the verse is, and he will give you the desires of your heart. I think you need to see that in balance. And we don't see that second half. He will give you the desires of your heart. And I think we need to begin, in terms of planning, to dream with relation to our churches. To dream. What could happen? What might happen? What's conceivable if God would just bless us? And begin to look around in your community and look up on the third story of some of the homes, if that's the kind of area you're in, and begin to see some of the widows living up there in single rooms, or some of the single parent families, or begin to dream, what could really happen in our church? Lyle Schaller wrote a book, Effective Church Planning, and I think this is significant. He said, the difference between a problem-oriented and a potentialities-oriented perspective may determine whether we plan for yesterday or for tomorrow. Now let me ask you whether your church, when your session meets, when your deacons meet, are you basically problem-oriented or potentialities-oriented, dream-oriented, fantasy-oriented? Do you begin by listing problems, basically, or potentials? Now, he says this about the first. If you're problem-oriented, then everything's in the past in your discussion. And that's nice because it's more familiar. It's easier to deal with. That encourages pessimism. That focuses attention on solutions to problems. Then there's a preoccupation with liabilities. And all of the discussion moves in those kinds of areas. If you're dream-oriented and potentiality-oriented and fantasy-oriented, then everything's in the future in your discussion. And that's more risky. But it encourages optimism. and it nurtures creativity. And it focuses attention not on the liabilities, the difficulties, but it focuses attention on the assets. So let me urge you to dream for your church when you plan, when you begin to plan. Dream. What could happen? What might happen? Fantasize. Boy, wouldn't it be wonderful if? And then you have to back up to reality a little bit. You have to say, is the if even conceivable? For example, I can fantasize right now about myself being a microsurgeon. I mean, if I stood here for a little bit, I could really dream about that. I'm in the emergency room with my microscope and all kinds of things. But that's unreal. I'm too old, too uncoordinated. There's just no way. So I'd have to back off from that dream and say, well, that dream's not even possible. I'd have to back off and start all over again with another dream. All your dreams aren't going to work. Someday if you come and interview for a job and I'm the interviewer, there are two things I'd like to ask you. I'd like to ask you how often you said no. I'd like to ask you not what you've done in your life, but what did you refuse to do? That'll tell me some things about how you've ordered your life. The other thing I'd like to ask you is, tell me about some of your dreams that failed. Tell me about some of your dreams that failed. I don't think we're really dreaming unless we've got 10 dreams that aren't working. If you can hit 2 out of 10 with dreams, that's great. But if you're not dreaming at all, you're not going to hit anything. Just going to carry on the status quo, keep things moving, patch up the problem. Hope you'll have as many people next year as this year. Hope the bills will be paid. Hope the contributions keep up. Let me urge you to dream. Let me urge you to dream. And when you dream, then you plan. And you say, okay, there's the dream. We can see it. Can't see it clearly, but we can see it. Now we're going to plan to get there. And let me urge you to keep your plans flexible. Don't kill the dream. Don't kill the dream. You know, there are a lot of ways to kill dreams. Dream bombs, that's what I call them. Or dream busters, you know what they are. You come up with a dream and somebody says, don't be ridiculous. That'll kill it. Or it can't be done. Or we don't have time. Or we don't have enough money. It's not in the budget. Or we've never done it that way before. Or let's form a committee. Dream killers. Dream killers. Don't let that happen. Keep the dream alive. Dream and plan and then keep on dreaming, because the dream may change directions and the Lord may have something else in mind for you. Let the dream be flexible as you work it through. So that's the third thing. Wasting time. Organizing time is the third thing. Wasting time was first. Evaluating time is second. Now organizing time. Last thing, last item, expanding time. How do you get more time? How do you get more time? Well, you can't have any more. Let me ask you how much more you need. How much more time do you think would do it for you? 50% more? 36-hour day, would that do it? Well, I'm sorry, it just can't do it. You don't get any more time. So how do you expand time? Well, what you do is get more value out of the time you have. That's time expansion as I'm looking at it. There are some suggestions that can be made to individuals, to executives, to ministers. You can read the books. You can save time with mail. Now, I said mail is a time waster. How do you save time with mail if you're a minister, if you're an executive, if you're a businessman? Well, you answer it right away. Letter comes in, you answer it. You don't put it down on your desk and keep picking it up 10 times. That's a time waster. You answer it right away. And you learn to answer letters by scribbling on the back of the other guy's letter and sending it back to him, or on the bottom of the letter if you don't need to keep it or keep a copy of it. Or you learn to write 3-sentence letters instead of these long letters that begin, thank you for your letter of August 15th, in which you said so-and-so. He knows he sent the letter to you. You learn to write more brief letters when that's appropriate. Or you handle all your letters at the same time. You save them all for when you're tired, downtime, low energy time, late in the afternoon. So you can save time with letters. Or the telephone, you learn how to use that more efficiently, more effectively. You learn to call shut-ins before you go to visit them to see if they're home. I learned to do that. I used to like to cross them off my list when they weren't home. Didn't have to go see them then. But you learn to call ahead when you go to the hospital, even see if people have checked out, that sort of thing. You use a phone to save time. You use a phone to have a committee meeting. If your committee's small enough, then you don't have to go out. You can do it in 15 minutes at home. Go back and be with your family or whatever you're doing at home. So you can save time with a telephone. You can save time in reading. I took a speed reading course one time in Philadelphia. I forget whose it was, Evelyn Woods or one of these. And the girl that was my teacher was very gracious and learned and educated, and I really appreciated her devotion to her task. And we got about halfway through the thing, and And I was whipping through Call of the Yukon or whatever it is, and I was just whipping through that thing. You know, you move a thing down, and I don't know how many words a minute I was reading it. Call of the Wild. Which is it? Call of the Yukon, Call of the Wild? Call of the Wild? Whichever. Okay, I was whipping through that thing tremendous speed, and the course was half over. And I said to the very gracious girl, I said, now look, I can really do this Call of the Yukon stuff, but my problem is I've got to read John Calvin. Now I want to know, I said to her, how fast could you read John Calvin? And she said, oh, maybe 300 words a minute. And I thought, well, I can do just about that well, and I dropped out of the course. I don't know how to speed read. I didn't take the full advantage of the course. I don't know how to speed read. But I have learned to skim, and that's different from speed reading. I can read a book now in 15 minutes. You know, there's a book that comes out, and for some reason I have it, or somebody gave it to me to read. People give you books to read. You can read a book in 15 minutes. You look through, you look at the first part of each chapter. That's not speed reading, it's skimming. I used to get a very well-known magazine, and I won't mention the name of it because this is on tape. Somebody get mad at me, but it was a well-known news magazine. It's on all the newsstands, and half of you get it. And I found I was reading every word in that. I thought I was learning a whole lot about everything. I finally realized that those articles, every one of them came down to nothing. They just came down to blah, no conclusion, no point, and I just decided I wouldn't read that magazine anymore. And so I've tried to budget my reading time a little bit. Budget my reading time a little bit. So there are things you don't have to read at all. There are things you can skim. There are things you ought to read very carefully. So you can save time reading, even if you're not a speed reader. But how about in the church? How can we save time? Well, first of all, let me make this suggestion as a general suggestion, and that is that you have small committees. I think that can be a time saver. Have small committees. In most of the churches where I function, there's been an inclination to go to large committees. And a large committee can be helpful, and committees can be useful. Don't misunderstand me. Even a big committee. Sometimes you need the input of people from varying backgrounds. And you want them all in the room as you discuss the subject. So sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes you need the support of people later on, so you want to get them involved in the committee. I'm not sure that's always good, but sometimes it may be. Sometimes it's just too much work for one person, and so you need to divide the labor up in one way or another. But I think basically, at least in most of my experience, small committees will do it. How small? I think, frankly, the ideal size of a session committee is probably one person. I think that's enough for most tasks. Maybe two if you know, you really need some interaction, but I think basically one's enough on a session committee. Now think of what that does. You have a committee on your session with one person on it, and next month there's time for committee reports, and he knows, and so does everyone else, who's responsible for whatever happened or didn't happen on that committee. He knows he's responsible, and only is he responsible. He can't hide in the committee. And my suspicion is that most people will function better that way than they will hidden in a big committee with 15 people where they have to go to burdensome meetings and sit all night, one person on a committee. Just think about how that would work in your church. If instead of these big committees, you had one person. In one of my churches, I tried that, and it fell like a bomb. Didn't work. They didn't even try it. I tried it, but they didn't. After a year or two, we tried it, and I thought it worked with some success, but surely not in the beginning. We had a session with 18 members, and traditionally there had been only three committees, so they took six here, six there, six here, divided all the work of the church up and put it under one of those three committees. Now, what that really meant to me was nobody trusts anybody in this group. But what it also meant to me was if I had a creative idea, I'd go to an elder or two and we'd talk about it. Then I'd go to one of these committees and work it through them. Then we'd go to the session and I'd work it through the session. And by then, I had lost all interest in my creative idea, and I can think of one very good example. I wanted to have small groups when I first went to the church. We had about 600 members, and I figured I'm never going to get to know all these people before they die. And maybe what I could do is have small groups, zone meetings we called them, and I and the other two ministers will go to every one of them. We had 18 of them planned. We were going to go to all 18, all three ministers, all 18. I thought it was a good idea. It meant more work for me, but I thought it'd be a good way to expose myself and get exposed to the congregation. Well, by the time I worked that thing through that system, it just died. We went ahead and did it, but I did it with a lot less enthusiasm than I had had. So one time saver I'm suggesting to you is small committees. One person, maybe two. Now, if you have two, they can meet on the telephone at 7 o'clock of an evening. call up Bill, call up John, call up Mary, if there's a woman on the committee with you, and say, look, let's talk this over. You got 15 minutes? No. All right, I'll call back at 8:30. Don't have to go out. You can watch television. Do whatever's higher on your priority list for that particular night. Small committee. Second thing, save time, has to do with meetings. Meetings. Now, Marlon Hardman tonight shared with us some good things about meetings, and I certainly want you to read some of these things against that background, but how can you save time with meetings? Well, one thing you can do is begin on time, and we tried tonight, and we're going to try to end on time. I think that's important. Begin and end on time. Another thing you can do is do your homework before the meeting. If you have a report to give, mimeograph it, Xerox it, whatever. You know what a mimeograph machine is? It's a church mimeograph machine is a holy roller. I don't know where I heard that, but anyway, be sure you do your homework so that when you come in to a meeting, whether you're the pastor or committee chairman, whatever, you've done all of your homework and you can lay it out in front of everybody. You don't have to get into a long harangue getting your homework out. Be sure that a meeting that you're involved in has goals that are set so you know where you're going with the meeting. These are time savers, I think. Be sure that you have an agenda that's been prepared in advance, even shared in advance, if that will be helpful. Keep a meeting moving. Keep a meeting moving. Be sure that actions that are taken are put in a position where they can be implemented. That's a time saver. So that next month if somebody said, well, last time we voted to do so-and-so, what happened? You don't say, I don't know what happened. Nothing happened. Meetings. What can we do to save time in meetings? Here's a suggestion. Set meetings before some stated hour for something else. Like, for example, if you have an evening service at, say, 7 o'clock, have a session meeting at 6 o'clock on Sunday, if you think it'd be okay to do that on the Lord's Day. I think it is. But have a session meeting at 6 o'clock if you have a church service at 7. Or if you're going to have a congregational dinner, say, on Friday night at 7, have a session meeting at 6. Have a session meeting when there's a terminal date at which it has to end, especially before a dinner. And halfway through, you can be sure some elder who normally would prolong the meeting long into the night will say, we got to hurry, the dinner's in a half hour. But I think that's a useful suggestion. And if you don't finish in that week, you meet the next week. Most of you are out anyway for that particular meeting, whatever it is, a dinner or worship service. So maybe that's a way to save time on meetings. But I think we need to work on meetings. One other way to expand time is to delegate. Now that's true in business and it's true in the Bible. Read Exodus 18 and see how Moses, under the Lord, delegated his authority to other people. Delegate. Give away your work. Now, that doesn't mean getting other people to do what they should do. It means getting other people to do what's your job. And we don't delegate in the church, and it's dumb. It's unbiblical, and it's dumb. It's unspiritual. It's unscriptural and dumb. We don't delegate. Ministers don't delegate. Now, don't misunderstand me. I understand that I, as a minister, am of no higher level than any ruling elder. I don't misunderstand, but there's a sense in which the minister is at the head of the organization, and then comes the session, and then come the other bodies of the church. And we don't delegate. Ministers don't. Why? Are they afraid somebody will think they're unimportant and unneeded? Why? We should learn to delegate. It's just not fair. We believe in the priesthood of all believers. We believe that all Christians are ministers in the name of Jesus Christ. And we cheat them. We take away from them the opportunities for service. We had last year some seminars for deacons. And one of the things we emphasized over and over again was that the deacon's job is not to do the ministry of mercy. The deacon's job is to organize the church to do the ministry of mercy. The ministry of mercy should not be done in your church by 5 deacons or 7 deacons or 9 deacons. The ministry of mercy should be done by all the members of your church. And it's foolish not to use those resources. And we don't delegate. Why don't we delegate? I think we're afraid. We're afraid. Now, of course, when you delegate, then you're asking for people to work. And that's another subject unto itself. How do you do that? I don't think you ask from the pulpit, I'd like volunteers to do so and so. I think that's dangerous and risky. You'll get the wrong people. And when you get the wrong people into a job in a church, it's tough to get rid of them. I think the way you organize a church for mission is one-on-one. I think ministers have lunch with their elders and talk to them and get to know them. And begin to say, what would you really like to do for Jesus' sake? And you know, I think a way to go about this is not to set up all the needs of the church and then to slot the people into the needs, but go visit the people first. Go visit the elders and find out what they'd like to do that they can do for the Lord. In other words, get an attention focused on the gifts and not the needs. and then begin to use people in all kinds of directions. One thing to beware of in the church is delegation up. You've got the minister at the top, in a sense, and then the session, then everyone else. There's a sense in which many of our churches function in the opposite direction, and everything gets delegated up. Somebody's got a problem with their neighbor, and really that person ought to go see the neighbor. Somebody's neighbor's in the hospital, and really that person ought to go see them. That's the Christian contact, and instead they call the minister. That's delegation up, reverse delegation. A few concluding remarks, and I'll be done. We've been looking at the church's resources, primarily people, which I've defined in terms of time. Mackenzie says about time, it can't be accumulated, it's irretrievable, and it moves relentlessly on time. Do you have enough time? How much more can you use? Well, I just tell you tonight, there isn't any more. Alec Mackenzie says in The Time Trap, which is a well-known recent book on this subject, its subtitle is How to Get More Done in Less Time. He says this, each of us already has all the time there is.